So good morning, welcome everybody to the 45th anniversary commemoration of, the 45th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. King. My name is Jared Ball, professor of communication studies here at Morgan State University. We have a tight schedule, so as students are coming in, you know, please just take your seat and welcome. Good morning again to everybody. What we wanted to do today was have a collective of people come through and talk about as much as possible, or give an introduction as much as possible to the real Dr. King, the Dr. King that existed in real life versus the Dr. King that has been re-imaged into something else, quite different from the King that actually existed. And we wanted to put this in the context of the counterintelligence program, the FBI's effort to destroy all radical efforts, all radical movements in this country. To sort of have an assessment of not only the real Dr. King, but where we are today and what we might want to do next. So I'm just going to give an introductory presentation to sort of draw some of the rough context of this using mainstream media and the Washington Post in particular. And then Dr. Burroughs is going to come up and talk about Dr. King and more broad press tradition, media, black press. Exactly. And then Dr. Bolden will come up and put all of this in the context of an African continuum of liberation struggles, and then the rest of the day will proceed accordingly. We already did that. So some of what we're going to talk about today is the politics of image and the assassination of symbol, and be reminded again of the counterintelligence program that was initiated by the FBI. And as it says here, the counterintelligence program, or COINTELPRO, mounted by the FBI, had a goal to disrupt, misdirect, discredit, and otherwise neutralize the civil rights, black liberation, Puerto Rican independence, Native American, anti-war, socialist, and new left movements of the 1960s and 70s, and is one of the most notorious of the U.S. government's domestic anti-radical programs. They involved themselves in what they called black propaganda, the distribution of fabricated articles, leaflets, etc., that misrepresented the politics and objectives of an organization or leader in order to discredit the group or individual and to pit people and organizations against one another. And again, this is sort of the context in which we want to talk about the image and the life of, in the politics of Dr. King. More specifically, regarding Black America or the African world in this country, the FBI's goal was to prevent the rise, as they said, quoting their own memorandum, prevent the rise of a Black Messiah who could unify and electrify the militant Black nationalist movement. Malcolm X might have been such a Messiah. He is the martyr of the movement today. Martin Luther King, Stokely Carmichael, and Elijah Muhammad all aspire to this position. King could be a very real contender for this position should he abandon his supposed obedience to white liberal doctrine of nonviolence and embrace Black nationalism. So as late as 66, and really, as we'll see in a moment, after 1963, the FBI had developed a plan aimed at neutralizing Dr. King as an effective Negro leader in light of Dr. King's powerful demagogic speech, talking about the March on Washington, I Have a Dream speech. We must mark him now, if we have not done so before, as the most dangerous Negro in the future of this nation from the standpoint of communism, the Negro and national security. And this is William Sullivan speaking of Dr. King as the head of Hoover's COINTELPRO program in 1963. So this sort of sets the context in which I want to just say a few words about the way the press treated Dr. King to show what his real relationship was to this country. And as you see here, in January of 1966, King is considered a most admired man. He's top 10 in terms of most admired people or great men of the year, as considered by the elite, the establishment of this country. And of course, that's right after the assassination, or not long after the assassination of Malcolm X, where this country was looking to replace people like Malcolm with more acceptable leadership. But then King immediately goes off the rails from the perspective of those in power. In January of 1966, he launched in Chicago the most significant Northern freedom movement ever attempted by a major civil rights group, whose primary goal was, or objective, was to bring about the unconditional surrender of forces dedicated to the creation and maintenance of slums, and to ultimately make slums a financial and moral liability upon the whole community. And again, you can start to see the difference between King and other so-called leadership particularly the leadership we have today. In February, the year after the assassination of Malcolm X, Dr. King meets with the black Muslim leader, Elijah Muhammad, who was also named as a potential COINTELPRO threat. And then he talks about continuing this work in the northern ghettos, in Chicago in particular, that he said, he and his group said that they would go to the communities, the so-called slums and ghettos, and they would collect the rent. But then, as they said here, the rent would presently being paid to the landlord will be paid to us. Dr. King's and other associated community activist organizations, and then we will use the rent to renovate the building. Direct confrontation with what makes slums possible, and then talking about, which is really redistributionist wealth, collecting people's money and then using it for the good of the community as opposed to private gain. March 31st, 1966, let me just back up here. March 31st, 1966, Dr. King accepts the pressure or concedes to the pressure to not talk about Vietnam. And this is an important point we'll come back to throughout the day, where pressure was being put on Dr. King and the civil rights movement not to say anything about the Vietnam War, to, as we'll see in a moment, as it says here, stick to your own knitting. In April of 1966, he's warned, stick to your own knitting. Don't talk about the Vietnam War, because as they were warned, this would seriously jeopardize new legislation you were trying to gain for your civil rights struggle. So don't talk about Vietnam. Keep everything to local civil rights politics, as you've been doing, and you might get some legislation. They go farther in May of 1966 to have more than 100,000 people signed a petition against Dr. King and others brought up on charges of un-American activities with HUAC, the House Committee on Un-American Activities, whose history deserves more attention than we're giving it today. But the point being, Dr. King was already being seen as a threat, and this idea that he might start talking about Vietnam, and then it's seen here, he's meeting with leaders of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, he's meeting with black Muslims, and all of this is considered dangerous, that he's going, again, as the COINTELPRO documents warned, going off the rails. And then there's actually calls, that some of which come from within the civil rights establishment, to investigate communist infiltration into so-called civil rights groups. We know Thurgood Marshall and others were involved in calling for this kind of investigation of King and others in the NAACP, looking at some of the contradicting history. Skipping ahead a little bit to April 4th, 1967, sort of a turning point for Dr. King in terms of his public expression of his real politics. He gives the famous Riverside Church speech in New York, where he says, among many other things, as I have walked among the desperate, rejected, and angry young men, I have told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles would not solve their problems. I have tried to offer them my deepest compassion while maintaining my conviction that social change comes most meaningfully through nonviolent action. But they asked, what about Vietnam? They asked if our own nation wasn't using massive doses of violence to solve its problems, to bring about the changes it wanted. Their questions hit home, and I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. So King is saying the black power movement, the more militancy that's developing, I'm not necessarily fully in agreement with, but I understand its origins, and more importantly, I see the contradiction between the United States saying be peaceful while they're being violent abroad. And in terms of what I'm trying to cover here briefly this morning, the Washington Post, in reaction to that article, many other major press outlets said something very similar, that this speech was a tragedy, the Washington Post said, that Dr. King diminished his usefulness to his cause, to his country, and to his people. So you start to see the change in the way the national press starts to talk about Dr. King. Further damage done by Dr. King. In February of 1968, he appeals to the middle class. He attacks the black bourgeoisie and says, you cannot be a conscientious objector in the war against poverty, and criticizes the black middle class for walking off and taking the gains struggled by for those in the civil rights movement and not contributing equally to the people's movement in response. There was no reciprocal relationship, in other words, between the black middle class and the black community, as King was starting to see and be more vocal about. Again, if we contrast that with today's leadership, so-called, we start to see important, serious contradictions. Then, less than 90 days before he's assassinated, this to me is one of the more damning public statements made by the mainstream press. In February 19th, 1968, the headline is, "The fear is growing among top officials in the White House and Justice Department that Dr. King's March of the Poor will be a stunning victory for Stokely Carmichael." Again, another one of the named threats by counterintelligence program documents. Yet they're seeing him working. They're seeing King working with Stokely Carmichael and more radicals and accepting them into his work. The article associates Dr. King with Lenin, V.I. Lenin, the leader of the Russian Revolution, says the Communist Party's taking over, and so on. So what they're basically saying, if you study political assassination, is they're basically saying he's the next target. He is a threat to national security, and therefore he must go. And then, of course, you get this, where the assassination does actually take place, April 4th, 1968. And just to sort of make this connection to the counterintelligence program, as we'll continue to talk about the rest of the day, Merrill McCullough is the first to Dr. King's body and first to point falsely to the rooming house away from the bushes. And by the way, if you look in the lower left-hand corner, you see people milling around. This is after the shots had been fired. This is after people apparently thought the threat was gone. And it's then that you see what has become this sort of false propaganda picture of the pointing away from where the shots actually came. This was a distraction. Again, if you look at the lower left-hand corner, nobody feels like there's a continuing threat. So this is not immediately after the shot was fired, despite the way the picture is depicted in history. Like, this is supposed to be the immediate moment, and they're pointing across to the rooming house to set up James Earl Ray, when the shots, for most people who have been researching this, came from below. Further, McCullough at the time was an undercover Memphis police officer, an agent provocateur, and he would later join the CIA in 1974. There's a stark parallel between this and, for instance, the Malcolm X assassination, where again the first person to Malcolm's fallen body was an undercover agent working for the NYPD's Bureau for Special Service, BOSI, Bureau of Special Services and Investigation, which is sort of the COINTELPRO unit of the New York City Police Department. So in this brief and quick overview, I hope we've gotten at least a look at how the national press depicted Dr. King as he expanded beyond 1963, engaged in more radical politics, engaged in more direct confrontation with capitalism and white supremacy and the contradictions that occur within the black community, most notably along the lines of class, where the black middle class was targeted by Dr. King, as were white liberals, for not doing all that they were supposed to have been doing to advance the struggle. And the black poor was unjustly suffering the worst of the movement and getting the least of the gains from the movement. And as we'll hear from the rest, coming up with Dr. Burroughs and throughout the rest of the day, this is an important piece of understanding how this country really felt about Dr. King when he was assassinated, that he was a threat, he was dangerous, he was not the national hero that he's been depicted since then, and that all the things that he was struggling to eradicate have in fact worsened and are worsening through to today. All right. So again, thank you very much. Dr. Burroughs will come on up and then continue the presentation. Thank you all very much.